Part 6. Wave. I was mistaken. Fourth entry for the 21st day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the southwestern halls. I was sitting cross-legged with my journal in my lap and the fragments in front of me. I turned away slightly, not wanting to soil any of them, and vomited on the pavement. I was shaking. I fetched myself a drink of water, as well as a rag and some more water, to wipe up the vomit. I was mistaken. The other is not my friend. He has never been my friend. He is my enemy. I was still shaking. I had the cup of water in my hand, but I could not hold it steady. I had known once that the other was my enemy, or rather Matthew Rose Sorensen had known it. But when I had forgotten Matthew Rose Sorensen, I had forgotten this as well. I had forgotten, but the other remembered. I could see now that he was apprehensive, in case one day I remembered. He called me Piranesi, so he would not need to use the name Matthew Rose Sorensen. He tested me by speaking words such as Battersea to see if they sparked any memories. I had been incorrect when I said that Battersea was nonsense. It was not nonsense. It was a word that meant something to Matthew Rose Sorensen. But why was the other able to remember when I was not? Because he did not stay in the house, but went back to the other world. Revelations came thick and fast now. My head seemed to shudder with the weight of them. I clasped my head in my hands and groaned. I must not stay long, the prophet had said. I am all too well aware of the consequences of lingering in this place. Amnesia, total mental collapse, etc., etc. Like the prophet, the other never lingered. He never allowed our meetings to last longer than an hour, and at the end of them, he walked away, and when he did that, he was walking away into the other world. But how could I make sure that I did not forget again? I pictured myself forgetting and becoming the other's friend again, and running about the house, taking measurements and photos and collecting data for him, while all the time he was laughing at me. No, 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 no. I could not bear the thought of it. I pressed my head between my hands as if I could physically keep the memories from escaping. I will learn from 16 and collect marble pebbles from the vestibules and form letters with them. I will write in letters a meter high, remember, the other is not your friend. He tricked Matthew Rose Sorensen into coming into this world for his own advantage. If necessary, I will fill hall after hall with immense writing. For his own advantage. Yes. Yes, that was the key to it. That was why he had brought Matthew Rose Sorensen here. The other had needed someone, a slave, to live in these halls and collect information about them. He dares not do it himself in case the house makes him forget. Furious, hot anger rose up inside me. Why? Why had I told him about the flood? If only I had learnt all this before I knew about the flood. Then I could have kept it a secret. I could have waited until Thursday came, and I could have climbed up to a high place, safe from the waters, and I could have watched him destroyed. Yes, that is what I want now. Perhaps it is not too late. I will go back to the other. I will smile and look as usual, and I will deceive him as he has deceived me. I will say I made a mistake about the flood. No flood is coming. Be here on Thursday. Be in the very middle of these halls. But of course, the other has said that he will not be here on Thursday. He is never here on Thursdays. He will be safe in the other world. That does not matter. Anger makes me resourceful. On Tuesday, the other will come to meet me. It is our regular meeting day. I will snatch him and bind him with fishing nets. With these hands I will do it. I have two fishing nets. They are made of a synthetic polymer and very strong. I shall bind him to the statues in the second southwestern hall. For 2 days he will be bound. He will be in torment, knowing the flood is coming. Perhaps I will give him water to drink. Perhaps I will not. Perhaps I will say to him, soon you will have plenty of water. And on Thursday he will watch the tides pouring in through the doors, and he will scream and scream, and I will laugh and laugh. I will laugh as long and as loud as he laughed at Matthew Rose Sorensen when he brought him here. This is where I lost myself. I lost myself in long, sick fantasies of revenge. I did not think to rest. I did not think to eat. I did not think to drink water. Hours passed. I do not know how many. I wandered about, and over in my imagination, the other died in the flood, or he fell from a great height. And sometimes I raved at him and accused him. And sometimes I was cold and silent, and he begged me to tell him why I had turned against him, but I did not. And always I could have saved him, but I never did. These imaginings left me ravaged. I do not think I could have felt more exhausted if I really had murdered someone 100 times over. My thighs ached, my back ached, my head ached, my eyes and throat were sore with weeping and shouting. When night came, I made my way back to the Third Northern Hall. I collapsed on my bed and slept. It is 16 that is my friend and not the other. Entry for the 22nd day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the Southwestern Halls. I awoke this morning exhausted from the excesses of the day before. I went to the 9th vestibule to gather seaweed and mussels to make a broth for my breakfast. I felt dull and empty, with no appetite for further anger. Yet, despite this emotional blankness, from time to time a sob or cry would escape my lips, a little sound of desolation. I did not believe it was myself that cried out. It was, I thought, Matthew Rose Sorensen, who reposed in a state of unconsciousness somewhere inside myself. He had suffered. He had been alone with his enemy. It had been more than he could bear. Perhaps the other had taunted him. Matthew Rose Sorensen had torn into pieces the description of his enslavement that he had written in his journal, and he had scattered the pieces in the 88th Western Hall. Then the house, in its mercy, had caused him to fall asleep, which was by far the best thing for him, and it had placed him inside me. But the sight of his name, written in pebbles in the 24th vestibule, had caused him to stir uneasily, and the revelation of what the other had done had only made matters worse. I worried in case he woke up completely, and his anguish began all over again. I placed my hand on my chest. "Hush now," I said. "Do not be afraid. You are safe. Go back to sleep. I will take care of us both." It seemed to me that Matthew Rose Sorensen fell asleep again. I thought of all those journal entries that I had read, the ones about Giussani, Ovenden, D'Agostino, and poor James Ritter. I had thought that I was mad when I wrote them, but I could now see that this conclusion was incorrect. I had not written the entries at all. He had written them, and what is more, he had written them in a different world, where, no doubt, different rules, circumstances, and conditions applied. As far as I can tell, Matthew Rose Sorensen was in his right mind when he wrote them. Neither he nor I had ever been mad. Another revelation came to me. It was the other who wanted me to be mad, not 16. The other had lied when he said 16 was trying to drive me insane. I made my seaweed and mussel broth and drank it. It was important to keep up my strength. Then I took up my journal again. I turned back to the message that 16 had written and which I had erased, leaving only fragments. Is Valentine Ketterly? Certainly groomed other potential victims, and I, a disciple of the occultist Lawrence Arne Sayles. I saw now that this whole passage was about Ketterly. The victims 16 talked about were not 16's own, but, most likely, Ketterly's. Had he tricked others into coming into this world? Or was Matthew Rose Sorensen the only victim? The word potential suggested that 16 believed me to be the only one. Think he knows that I have penetrated the... This too referred to Ketterly. 16 was saying that Ketterly knew that she had arrived in these halls, which he knew because I had told him. Inwardly, I cursed my own stupidity. So why had 16 come? Because she was looking for Matthew Rose Sorensen. Because she wanted to rescue him from the slavery of the other. I saw it clearly now. It is 16 that is my friend, and not the other. Tears sprang into my eyes at the thought. My only friend, and I had hidden from her. I am here! I am here! I shouted to the empty air. Come back! I will hide no longer! So many times I could have found her. I could have spoken to her that night when she knelt to write to me in the 6th Northwestern Hall. I could have waited by the trail of her perfume in the first vestibule. Perhaps she had given up looking for me. Perhaps she had been disgusted when she saw how I hid from her, how I erased her message. But no. She had formed that sentence in the 24th vestibule. Are you Matthew Rose Sorensen? It would have taken a long time to arrange those pebbles. 16 was patient, resolute, and ingenious. 16 was still looking for me. Perhaps by now she had found my message warning her of the flood. Perhaps she had written something in return. I washed my bowl and the saucepan I had made my soup in. I put my possessions in order. Then I set out for the 6th Northwestern Hall. The rooks made a fuss at my approach. Yes, yes, I am glad to see you too, I told them. Only I have things to do today and cannot stop for a long conversation. There was no new message from 16. But something very worrying had happened. My message, warning her of the flood, had vanished. All our other messages were here, but not that one. I gazed at the empty pavement in perplexity. What had happened? I know that I have forgotten many things. Have I now started to remember things that have not happened? Had I, in fact, never written that message at all? I passed from the 6th Northwestern Hall into the 24th vestibule where 16 had constructed the message, Are you Matthew Rose Sorensen? The pebbles that had formed the words were scattered far and wide over the pavement. The words were utterly destroyed. The other. The other had done this. I was quite sure of it. I went back to the 6th Northwestern Hall and examined the pavement carefully. I could see the faint traces of chalk where my warning had been. The other had erased this message too. Why? He had scattered the pebbles in order to prevent me finding out about Matthew Rose Sorensen. That much was clear. But why erase the message to 16? In the hope that she would accidentally wander into the perilous region and be destroyed by the flood? No. The other does not hope. He plans and acts. He wanted her to drown, and he would try to ensure it. 3 months ago, when the other had first told me about 16, he said that he had spoken to her. But when I asked him where this conversation had taken place, he had become confused and would not tell me. That was because it had happened in the other world, the existence of which the other wanted to keep hidden from me. The other would contact 16 in the other world and convince her to come to these halls at the hour of the flood. Perhaps he had already done it. 16 was in danger. I knelt down and quickly and efficiently restored the message the other had erased. If 16 comes here between now and Thursday, she will see the message and receive the warning of the flood. And yet, only 5 days remain between now and Thursday. Supposing she does not come in this period? This seems to me perfectly possible. Now that I know she comes from somewhere else, another world, it seems to me that her visits are irregular and unpredictable. There is a risk she will not see it. And so I am in a state of some anxiety concerning her. My thoughts return constantly to her and her safety. Yet I cannot think of anything else I can do to protect her. Preparations for the Flood. Entry for the 26th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the southwestern halls. With the exception of the concealed person, all the dead stand in the path of the floodwaters. On Sunday, I began the work of carrying them to safety. I took a blanket and transferred all the biscuit box man's bones into it, all except for the ones inside the biscuit box. I tied up the blanket with seaweed twine, making it into a sort of sack, and I carried it to the second vestibule and up the staircase to the upper hall. There I emptied out the blanket and placed the bones on the plinth of a statue of a shepherdess with a lamb in her arms. Then I went back for the biscuit box. I did the same for the people of the alcove and the folded-up child, carrying each of them up a staircase, whichever staircase was nearest to their usual habitation, and storing them carefully in one of the upper halls. I did not empty out the fish leather man, but kept him wrapped up in the blanket. He has so many tiny fragments of bone that I am afraid of losing some. Similarly, I left the folded-up child snuggled in a blanket, but that was more because I wanted her to feel safe in an unfamiliar place. It took me the best part of 3 days to complete the task. The bones of each individual dead person weigh between 2.5 and 4.5 kilograms, and the staircases are 25 meters high. Yet I found that it was good to do hard physical work. It prevented me from continually obsessing over the injuries the other has done me and my fears concerning 16. I had not forgotten the albatross chick, now a very large bird. I did a series of calculations to find out how the 43rd vestibule would be affected by the flood, and was relieved to discover that there would be, at most, only a thin skin of water. The albatrosses consider me a friend, but I did not think they would allow me to carry their chick up a staircase, and in any struggle between us, they would surely win. Yesterday was Tuesday, the day that I would normally go to my meeting with the other. I did not go. Was he suspicious, I wonder? Or did he simply think that I was too busy preparing for the flood? The statue of an angel caught on a rose bush, behind which I keep my journals and index, is approximately 5 meters from the floor, a height likely sufficient to keep them safe from the flood. But since my journals and index are almost as dear to me as my life, I have placed them all in my brown leather messenger bag, wrapped the messenger bag in heavy-gauge plastic, and carried it up to the upper halls and placed it beside the biscuit box man. I have stowed all my fishing gear, sleeping bags, pots and pans, bowls, spoons, and other possessions in high places out of the reach of the flood. My last task was to gather up the remaining plastic bowls, the ones I used to collect fresh water. I had just collected the last ones from the 14th Southwestern Hall and was carrying them back to the 3rd Northern Hall. On my way, I passed through the 1st Western Hall. This is the hall that contains the statues of the horned giants, those vast figures that emerge struggling powerfully and with contorted faces from the walls on either side of the eastern door. I observed something near the northeastern corner of the hall and went to look at it. It was a bag made of some grey fabric, and lying beside it, two objects made of black canvas. The bag was approximately 80 centimeters long, 50 centimeters wide, and 40 centimeters deep. It had two handles made of canvas, also grey. I picked it up. It was very heavy. I put it down again. It was fastened with two canvas straps that were held in place by metal buckles. I undid the buckles and opened the bag. I took out all the contents. They were as follows. A gun. A quantity of folded material made of a dense, heavy plastic. This was by far the largest object in the bag. It filled most of the bag and was colored blue, black, and gray. A small cylindrical container with a secure lid. This contained other small objects, the purpose of which was unclear. A thing like a slice of a larger cylinder cut down at an angle with a yellow hose coming out of it. Two black plastic rods extendable to a length of approximately 2 meters. Four black paddle shapes. After studying these items for a minute or two, I saw that the paddle shapes could be attached to the ends of the black rods. I unfolded the material. It became a long, flat shape which was pointed at both ends. It was a boat. The thing like a slice of a cylinder was a bellows, or pump. You pumped air into the long, flat shape and it would inflate and become a boat, about 4 meters long and 1 meter wide. I examined the two black canvas objects that had lain beside the bag. They had a number of straps hanging from them. I concluded that they must belong to the boat, but beyond this I could not ascertain their purpose. Why had a boat appeared suddenly in the house on the eve of the flood? Had the house sent it to me to keep me safe? I considered this proposition. There had been other floods in the past and no boat had appeared. Also, although I could imagine the house might send me a boat, I could not imagine any circumstances in which it would send me a gun. No. The gun proclaimed the bag's ownership. It was the others. I folded up the boat and packed everything neatly back in the bag, everything except the gun. I picked it up and held it for some time, thinking. I could take it and descend the great staircase in the first vestibule to the lower halls. I could throw it into the tides. I replaced the gun in the bag and did up the closures. I returned to the third northern hall. Wave. Entry for the 27th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the southwestern halls. Today was the day of the flood. I woke at my usual time. I was keyed up with nerves and my stomach was clenched tight. The day felt cold, and I could tell by the touch of the air on my skin that it was already raining in the vestibules. I had no appetite, but nevertheless I heated a little soup and forced myself to drink it. It is important to keep the body well nourished. I washed up my pan and bowl and stowed the last of my possessions behind high statues. I put on my watch. It was 7:45. My most important task was to find 16 and ensure her safety. But as to the best way to accomplish it, that was far from clear. I was certain that the other had set a trap for 16. Most likely he had promised to meet her in a certain hall at a certain time and to tell her how to find Matthew Rose Sorensen. This meant that the most reliable way to find 16 was to look for the other. But I did not want to go near the other if I could avoid it. I remembered the words of the prophet. The closer 16 gets, the more dangerous Ketterly will become. My hope was that I could find 16 before she reached the other. I went to the first vestibule. I stood in the grey rain and waited, hoping that she would appear. Between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock, I searched the adjacent halls. Nothing. At 10 o'clock, I returned to the first vestibule. At 10:30, I began to walk between the first vestibule and the 6th northwestern hall. I followed the path laid down in 16's directions. I trod this path 6 times, but I did not find her. I was growing extremely anxious. I returned to the first vestibule. It was now 11:30. 2 halls west and north of here, in the 9th vestibule, the first tide was already ascending the easternmost staircase. A delicate wash of water was scuttling over the pavements of the surrounding halls. There was nothing for it. I must look for the other. I had only just come to this decision when upon the instant he appeared in front of me. Why could 16 not do that? He walked briskly across the first vestibule, east to west. His head was ducked down against the rain. His clothes were strikingly different from what he usually wore. Jeans, an old jumper, and sneakers, and over his jumper, an odd sort of harness. Life jacket, I thought. Or rather, Matthew Rose Sorensen thought it inside my head. He did not see me. He passed into the first western hall. Silently, I followed him and hid myself in a niche near the door. The other went immediately to the bag containing the inflatable boat and began to unpack it. I waited, watching constantly, for 16. The other's attention was elsewhere, and there might still be enough time to intercept her if she entered the hall. Some distance behind the other, at the western end of the hall, I could see the glitter of light on the pavement. A film of water was washing through the northwestern doors. I glanced at my watch. 5 halls south and west of here, in the 22nd vestibule, another tide was already rising, tumbling up the staircase. The other unrolled his boat. He attached his little pump to it and began to pump with his foot. The boat began to inflate in an efficient manner. Water was filling up the 2nd and 3rd southwestern halls. I could hear the dull thud of the waves hitting their walls. Then it came to me. 16 was clever. She was at least as clever as me, perhaps even more so. She knew nothing about the flood, but she would not trust the other. She would wait and watch, as I was doing, hoping that Matthew Rose Sorensen would appear. Suddenly I had a mental image of both 16 and myself hiding in the 1st Western Hall, both waiting for the other one to appear. I could not afford to remain hidden any longer. I stepped down from the niche and walked towards the other. He glanced up and scowled as I approached. He did not pause in pumping up his boat. About 2 meters to his left was the gray bag, now empty, and beside it, resting on the pavement, was the silver gun. "Where the hell have you been?" he said in a voice of displeasure and anger. "Why weren't you there on Tuesday? I look for you everywhere. I can't remember if you said that 10 rooms will be flooded or 100. His foot on the pump was slowing. The inflatable boat was almost full of air and his foot was meeting with more resistance. "I've had to change my plans. It's a pain, but there it is. Raphael is coming here, and like it or not, we're going to finish this. So no nonsense from you, all right? Because I swear, Piranesi, I've just about had enough from everyone." "I visited him in mid-November," I said. "It was just after 4. A cold blue twilight." He stopped pumping. The boat was now a plump shape with a taut, rounded skin. "We attach the seats next," he said. "They're those black things over there. Pass them to me, will you?" He pointed to the 2 contraptions whose purpose I had not divined. "When the room floods, you and I will get into this kayak. If Raphael tries to get into it with us, or to hang on to it, use your paddle to strike at her hands and head." The afternoon had been stormy, I said, and the lights of the cars were pixelated by rain, the pavements collaged with wet black leaves. He was fiddling with the valves where the air had gone in. "What?" he asked irritably. "What are you talking about? Can you hurry up and pass me those seats? We need to get a move on. She'll be here any moment now." "When I got to his house, I heard music playing," I said. "A requiem. I waited for him to answer the door to an accompaniment of Berlioz." "Berlioz?" He stopped what he was doing, straightened, and looked at me properly for the first time. He frowned. "I don't... Berlioz?" I said, "The door opened." "Dr. Ketterly," I said. He froze at the sound of his own name. His eyes widened. "What are you talking about?" he asked again in a voice made hoarse with fear. "Battersea," I said. "You asked me once if I remembered Battersea, and now I do." Boom, boom. The tide from the 22nd vestibule was growing stronger. It was hitting the walls of the 2nd and 3rd southwestern halls with more force. "You saw her message," he said. "Yes," I said. A thin ripple of water raced across the pavement and hit my feet. It was followed immediately by another one. He laughed suddenly, an odd sound, hysteria masquerading as relief. "No, no," he said. "You don't get me that easily. Those aren't your words. They're someone else's. You don't really remember. Raphael put you up to this. Really, Matthew, how stupid do you think I am?" He dived suddenly to the right, towards the gun that was lying on the pavement, but I had chosen my position with care, and I was nearer to it than he was. I gave it a good, sharp kick with my foot. It skittered across the marble pavement and came to rest by the northern wall about 15 meters away. More ripples, deeper now, were coursing past our feet. They flowed after the gun, as if we were all playing a game with the gun and they intended to catch it.
"What? What are you going to do?" asked the other.
"Where is 16? I asked. He opened his mouth to say something, but at that moment a voice was heard.
"Ketterly!"
it cried. A woman's voice. 16 was here. From the sound, I judged that she was hidden in one of the southern doors. The other, who was not accustomed to the way in which the echoes reverberate in the halls, looked around him in a confused manner.
"Ketterly!" she shouted again. "I've come for Matthew Rose Sorensen."
He grabbed me by my right arm.
"He's here!" he shouted. "I have him! Come and get him!"
The booming of the tides was growing louder. The whole hall reverberated with the force of it. Water was flowing freely in through all the southern doors.
"Take care!" I shouted. "He means you harm! He has a gun!"
A small, slight figure stepped out of the door that leads to the first southern hall. She wore jeans and a green jumper. Her dark hair was pulled back into a ponytail. The other let go of me with his right hand, though he still had hold of me by his left. Then he made a fist of his right hand, and he swung his arm and body back, intending to get some momentum to hit me, but I swung with him, overbalancing him. He half fell to the floor. I pulled free from him and began to run towards 16. As I ran, I shouted, "A flood is coming! We must climb!" I do not know how much of my words she heard, but she understood the urgency in my voice. I seized her hand. Together we ran towards the eastern wall. The statues of the horned giants were in front of us on either side of the eastern door, but we could not climb them. Their bodies emerged from the wall 2 meters above the floor, and there were no hand or footholds until that point. Next to the giant, on the left, was the statue of a father seated with his little son in his arms. The father was plucking a thorn from his son's foot. I climbed into their niche and then onto their plinth. I mounted onto the father's lap, and by holding onto one of the columns at the side and using the arm, shoulder, and head of the father as footholds, I climbed onto the top of the triangular pediment that surmounted the niche. 16 tried to follow me, but she was not so tall as me and, I suspect, not accustomed to climbing. She got as far as the statue's lap, but seemed at a loss what to do next. Quickly, I climbed down again and lifted her up. With my help, she heaved herself up onto the pediment. It was noon. In the 10th and 24th vestibules, the last two tides were rising, filling the surrounding area with tempestuous, raging waters. Half a meter above the pediment was a deep cornice or shelf that ran the whole length of the hall. We scaled the slope of the pediment and hoisted ourselves onto the cornice above. We were now about 7 meters above the floor. 16 was pale and shaking. She clearly did not love climbing, but she had a fierce, determined expression. The air was suddenly rent by sharp cracking sounds, perhaps 4 of them, one after the other. For one terrifying moment, I thought that the weight and vibrations of the waters were causing the hall to collapse. I looked out into the hall, and I saw that the other had not yet got into his boat, where he would be safe. Instead, he had run to the northern wall to retrieve his gun. He was firing at us.
"Get in the boat!" I shouted to him. "Get in the boat before it is too late!"
He fired again, hitting a statue above our heads. I felt a sharp pain in my forehead. I cried out. I put my hand up and brought it away, covered in blood. The other started to wade through the running waters towards us, presumably with the idea of firing his gun at us more effectively. I shouted at him again, something to the effect that the tides were almost here. But there was a great roar of waters from every direction, and I doubt that he heard me. If there had not been someone firing a gun at us, we could have stayed on the cornice. Then, if the waters rose higher than I expected,
we could have climbed up again. But as matters stood, we were exposed, without protection. A meter or so below us, the back and upper arms of the horned giant emerged from the wall. There was a space between his back and the wall, a sort of marble pocket. I jumped. It was a distance of approximately 2 meters sideways, 1 meter down. I managed it with ease. I looked up at 16. Her eyes were wide with apprehension. I held out my arms. She jumped. I caught her. We were now shielded from the other's gun by the giant's body. I heaved myself up his marble back to look over his shoulder. The other had turned away from us and was trying to reach the boat, but he had left it too late. The waters were as high as his knees, and the contending waves were dragging at him. As he struggled, he seemed to grow heavier. The boat, by contrast, grew lighter, freer. It danced on the waters, spun from one part of the hall to another. One moment it was by the northern wall, the next it was halfway to the western wall. The other kept changing direction to follow it, but by the time he had taken a few arduous steps, the boat was somewhere else entirely. Suddenly, it was as if the boat remembered the purpose for which it had been brought here. It seemed to make up its mind to save him. It turned and sailed directly towards him. He held out his arms and leant forwards to catch it. It was barely half a meter from his grasp. For an instant, I think he had his hand on its bow. Then it twirled around and was gone, borne away to the western end of the hall. "Climb! Climb!" I shouted. It was too late to catch the boat, but I thought that if he climbed, he might still save himself. But he could not hear me above the sound of the waters pouring into the hall. He continued to wade desperately, uselessly, after the boat. There was a great rush and a great roar in the next hall. A weight of water hit the other side of the northern wall. Boom! And then I was grateful that we had climbed down to the horned giant. If we had still been standing on the cornice, we would have been flung off the wall. But the horned giant held us fast. Spray as high as the ceiling exploded through all the northern doors. The spray caught the sun. It was as if someone had suddenly thrown 100 barrelfuls of diamonds into the hall. Great waves surged through the northern doors. One plucked up the other and threw him against the southern wall. He crashed into the statues at a point about 15 meters from the floor. I imagine that that was when he died. The wave drew back. He disappeared into it. Meanwhile, the little inflatable boat whirled about on the waters, sometimes engulfed by them for a moment or two, but always reappearing immediately. If he could only have reached it, it would have saved him. Raphael. Second entry for the 27th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the southwestern halls. Waves crashed against the southern wall. Explosions of white spray filled the hall. The waters covered the bottom tier of statues. The color of the waters was a stormy gray, and their depths were black. Several times waves passed over our heads, but they fell back the next instant. We were drenched. We were numbed. We were blinded. We were deafened. But always, we were saved. Time passed. The waves sank down, and the waters became peaceable. They began to drain away into the staircases and the lower halls. The heads of the bottom tier of statues reappeared above the surface of the waters. In all this time, 16 and I had not spoken to each other. The roar of the waves would have made it impossible for us to hear each other, and in any case, we had been intent on saving ourselves and each other. We had had no thought for anything else. Now we turned and looked at each other. 16 had large dark eyes and an elfin face. Her expression was solemn. She was a little older than me, about 40, I thought. Her hair was black with wet. You are Raphael, I said. I'm Sarah Raphael, she said,
And you are Matthew Rose Sorensen. And you are Matthew Rose Sorensen. This time she framed it as a statement rather than a question. This was surely premature. It would have been better to keep it as a question. But then again, if she had framed it as a question, I would not have known how to answer it. Did he know you? I asked. Did who know me? She said. Matthew Rose Sorensen. Did Matthew Rose Sorensen know you? Is that why you came here? She paused, taking in what I had just said. Then she said carefully, No. You and I have never met. Then why? I'm a police officer, she said. Oh, I said. We fell back into silence. We were both still dazed by what had happened. Our eyes were still full of images of the violent waters. Our ears were still full of their sounds. Our minds were still full of that moment when the other was flung by the wave against the wall of statues. We had nothing at that moment to say to each other. Raphael turned her attention to practical matters. She examined the injury to my forehead and said that it was not very deep. She did not think that I had been hit by one of the other's bullets. More likely, I had been grazed by a shard of splintered marble. The level of the waters continued to fall. When they came no higher than the plinths of the bottom tier of statues, I began to consider how we would get down from the horned giant. We could not return the way we had come, since that would involve a leap upwards, onto the cornice. I did not think that Raphael could manage it. Indeed, I was not sure that I could either. I'll go and fetch something to help you climb down, I told her. Don't be anxious. I'll return as quickly as I can. I lowered myself from the giant's torso and dropped down. The waters reached as high as my thighs. I waded to the third northern hall and climbed up the statues to the places where I keep my belongings. Everything was wet from the spray, but nothing was drenched. I retrieved my fishing nets, a bottle of fresh water, and some dried seaweed. It is important to keep the body hydrated and nourished. I returned to the first western hall. The waters had already dropped some more and only came up as high as my knees. I climbed back up the horned giant. I gave Raphael some water and made her eat a little of the dried seaweed, though I do not think she liked it. Then I tied my fishing nets together and fastened them to one of the giant's arms. They hung down to a point about half a meter above the pavement. I showed Raphael how to use the fishing nets to climb down. We waded to the first vestibule and ascended the great staircase so that we were out of the reach of the waters. We sat down. Our clothes were plastered to our bodies with wet. My hair, which is dark and curly, was as full of droplets as a cloud. I rained every time I moved. The birds found us there, many different kinds. Herring gulls, rooks, blackbirds and sparrows gathered on the statues and banisters and chattered at me in their different voices. It'll be gone soon, I told them. Don't worry. What? Asked Raphael, startled. I don't understand. I was talking to the birds, I said. They're alarmed by the great quantities of water that are everywhere. I'm telling them that it'll soon be gone. Oh, she said. Do you talk to the birds often? Yes, I said. But there's no need to look surprised. You talked to the birds yourself. In the 6th Northwestern Hall. I heard you. She looked even more surprised at that. What did I say? She asked. You told them to piss off. You were writing a message to me, and they were being a nuisance, flying in your face and over your writing, trying to find out what you were doing. She thought a moment. Was that the message that you wiped out? She asked. Yes. Why did you do that? Because Dr. Ketterly told me you were my enemy, and that reading what you had written would make me go mad. So I erased the message. But at the same time, I wanted to read it, so I didn't erase all of it. I wasn't being very logical. He made things very hard for you. Yes, I suppose he did. There was a silence. We're both soaking wet and cold, said Raphael. Perhaps we should go. Go where? I said. Home, said Raphael. I mean, we can go to my house and get dry, and then I can take you home. I am home, I said. Raphael looked around at the somber grey waters lapping the walls and the dripping statues. She didn't say anything. It's usually a lot drier than this, I said quickly, in case she was thinking that my home was inhospitable and damp. But that wasn't what she was thinking. There's something I have to tell you, she said. I don't know if you remember this, but you have a mum and a dad and two sisters and friends. She gazed at me intently. Do you remember? I shook my head. They've been looking for you, she said. But they didn't know the right place to look. They've been worried about you. They've been... She looked away again to find the right words to express her thought. They felt pain because they didn't know where you were, she said. I considered this. I'm sorry that Matthew Rose Sorensen's mum and dad and sisters and friends feel pain, I said. But I don't really see what it has to do with me. You don't think of yourself as Matthew Rose Sorensen? No, I said. But you have his face, she said. Yes. And his hands? Yes. And his feet and his body? All that is true, but I haven't got his mind, and I haven't got his memories. I don't mean that he's not here. He is here. I touched my breast. But I think he's asleep. He's fine. You mustn't worry about him. She nodded. She was not a contentious person, as the other had been. She did not argue and contradict everything I said. I liked that about her. Who are you? She asked. If you're not him. I am the beloved child of the house, I said. The house. What is the house? Such a strange question. I spread my arms to indicate the first vestibule, the halls beyond the first vestibule, everything. This is the house. Look. Oh, I see. We were silent a moment. Then Raphael said, I need to ask you something. Would you be prepared to come with me to Matthew Rose Sorensen's parents and sisters to let them see his face again? It would help them a lot to know he is alive. Even if you had to go away again, I mean, even if you had to return here, it would help them. What do you think about that? I can't do it now, I said. Okay. I have to consider the needs of the biscuit box man and the folded up child and the people of the alcove. They only have me to take care of them. They are in unfamiliar surroundings and may feel disconcerted. I have to return them to their appointed places. There are other people here? Asked Raphael in surprise. Yes. How many? 13. The ones I have just said, and also the concealed person. But the concealed person resides in one of the upper halls and has not been affected by the flood, so there was no need to move him or her. 13 people! Raphael's dark eyes were wide with astonishment. My God, are they all right? Yes, I said. They're fine. I take good care of them. But who are they? Can you take me to them? Is Stanley Ovenden here? What about Silvia D'Agostino? Maurizio Giussani? Oh, it is highly probable that one of them is Stanley Ovenden. Certainly Lawrence Arne Sayles thought so. Another may be Silvia D'Agostino, and another Maurizio Giussani. Unfortunately, I have no idea which is which. What do you mean? Have they forgotten who they are? What do they say? Oh, they don't say much, really. They're all dead.
Dead?
Yes.
Oh.
Raphael took a moment to process this.
Were they dead when you arrived?
She asked.
I paused. It was an interesting question. I hadn't considered it before.
I think so, I said. I think they've all been dead a long time. But as I don't remember arriving, I can't be certain. Arriving was something that happened to Matthew Rose Sorensen, not to me.
Yes, I suppose that's right.
But what do you mean, you take care of them?
I make sure they are in good order, as complete and tidy as they can be. I bring them offerings of food and drink and water lilies, and I talk to them. Don't you have dead of your own in your halls?
I do, yes.
Don't you take them offerings?
Don't you talk to them?
Before Raphael could answer this, another thought struck me. I said there are 13 dead, but that is incorrect. Dr. Ketterly has joined their number. I must find his body and make him ready to lie with the others. I clapped my hands together. So as you see, I have a great many tasks to perform and cannot, at the moment, think about leaving these halls.
Raphael nodded slowly.
That's okay, she said. There's plenty of time.
She put out her hand and rather awkwardly, but also gently, put her hand on my shoulder. Instantly, and to my huge embarrassment, I started crying. Great creaking sobs rose up in my chest and tears sprouted from my eyes. I did not think that it was me who was crying. It was Matthew Rose Sorensen crying through my eyes. It lasted for a long time until it tailed off into braying, hiccuping gulps for air. Raphael still had her hand on my shoulder. She looked away tactfully while I wiped my eyes and my nose with the back of my hand.
You will come back, I said. Even though I don't go with you now, you will come back.
I'll come back tomorrow, she said.
It'll be rather late in the evening. Will that be okay? How will we find each other?
I'll wait for you here, I said. It doesn't matter how late it is. I'll wait until you come.
And you'll think about what I said. About coming to see to see Matthew Rose Sorensen's parents and sisters.
Yes, I said. I'll think about it. Raphael left, disappearing into the shadowy space between the two minotaurs in the southeastern corner of the vestibule. My watch had stopped, but I estimated it to be early evening. I was alone, exhausted, hungry, and wet. I waded back to the third northern hall. The water was still a half meter deep. I climbed up and examined the dry seaweed that I used to build fires. Unfortunately, it had been thoroughly wetted by the great waves. I could not make a fire. I could not cook anything. I fetched my sleeping bag, also damp, and took it to the first vestibule. I lay down on a dry, high step of the great staircase. My last thought before I fell asleep was, "He is dead. My only friend. My only enemy."
I comfort Dr. Ketterly. Entry for the 28th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the southwestern halls. I found Dr. Ketterly's body in an angle of the staircase in the 8th vestibule. He had been battered against the walls and the statues. His clothes were in rags. I disentangled him from the balustrade and laid him out straight and composed his limbs. I took his poor, broken head into my lap and cradled it.
"Your good looks are gone," I told him, "but you mustn't worry about it. This unsightly condition is only temporary. Don't be sad. Don't fear. I will place you somewhere where the fish and the birds can strip away all this broken flesh. It will soon be gone. Then you will be a handsome skull and handsome bones. I will put you in good order,
and you can rest in the sunlight and the starlight. The statues will look down on you with blessing. I am sorry that I was angry with you. Forgive me. I did not find the gun. The tides must have taken it deep within themselves. But later that morning I found Dr. Ketterly's boat, still idling on the waters in the First Western Hall, which were now no more than ankle deep. It was quite unharmed. I wish that you had saved him, I told it. I did not feel that it responded in any way. It seemed drowsy, dozing, only half alive. Without the rushing waters to animate it, it was no longer the devil that had danced on the waves, first mocking Dr. Ketterly, and then abandoning him. I'd been thinking about what Raphael said about Matthew Rose Sorensen's mum and his dad and his sisters and his friends. Perhaps I should send them a message explaining that Matthew Rose Sorensen now lives inside me, that he is unconscious but perfectly safe, and that I am a strong and resourceful person who will care for him assiduously, exactly as I care for any others of the dead. I shall ask Raphael what she thinks of this idea. As the shadows fell in the first vestibule, Raphael returned. Second entry for the 28th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the southwestern halls. As the shadows fell in the first vestibule, Raphael returned. We sat on a step of the great staircase as before. Raphael had a shining little device, like the one that the other had. She tapped it, and it brought forth a shaft of white-yellow light to illuminate the statues and our faces. I told Raphael my plan to write to Matthew Rose Sorensen's mum and dad and two sisters and friends, but for some reason she did not think this was a good idea. "What should I call you?" she asked. "Call me," I said, "as a name. If you're not Matthew Rose Sorensen, then what should I call you?" "Oh, I see. I suppose you could call me Pi—" I stopped. "Dr. Ketterly used to call me Piranesi," I said. "He said it was a name to do with labyrinths, but I think perhaps it was meant to mock me." "Probably," agreed Raphael. "He was that sort of guy." There was a little silence, and then she said, "Would you like to know how I found you?" "Very much," I said. "There was a woman. I don't suppose you remember her. Her name was Anherod Scott. She wrote a book about Lawrence Arne Sayles. 6 years ago, you contacted her. You told her that you were also thinking of writing a book about Arne Sayles, and the two of you had a long conversation. Then she never heard from you again. In May of this year, she called the college in London where you used to work, because she wanted to know what had happened about the book, whether you were still writing it. The people at the college told her that you were missing, that you'd been missing pretty much the entire time since she'd first spoken to you." That rang all sorts of warning bells for Mrs. Scott, because she knew about the people who had disappeared around Arne Sayles. You were the fourth, the fifth, if you count Jimmy Ritter. So she contacted us. It was the first time that the police, knew that there was any connection between you and Arne Sayles. When we talked to the people who remained of Arne Sayles' circle, Bannerman, Hughes, Ketterly, and Arne Sayles himself, it was obvious something was going on. Tali Hughes kept crying and saying she was sorry. Arne Sayles was thrilled by the attention, and Ketterly couldn't open his mouth without lying. She paused. "Do you understand any of what I'm saying?" "A little," I said. "Matthew Rose Sorensen wrote about all these people. I know that they are connected to the prophet, to Lawrence Arne Sayles. Did he tell you where I was?" "He said that he would." "Who?" "Lawrence Arne Sayles." Raphael took a moment to process this. "You spoke to him?" she asked in a tone of incredulity. "Yes." "He came here?" "Yes." "When?" "About 2 months ago."
"And he didn't offer to help you? He didn't offer to take you out of here?"
"No. But to be fair, if he had offered, I wouldn't have wanted to go. In fact, I'm still not sure that I want to go. A pale owl glided out of the first eastern hall into the first vestibule. It settled on a statue high up on the southern wall, where it gleamed whitely in the dimness. I have seen owls portrayed in marble. Many statues incorporate them. But I had never seen their living counterpart until now. Its appearance was, I felt sure, connected with the coming of Raphael and the departure of Dr. Ketterly. It was as though a principle of death had been replaced with a principle of life. Things, I thought, were speeding up. Raphael had not perceived the owl. She said, "You're right. Arne Sales told us the truth straight away. He said you were in the labyrinth. But of course, well, we thought he was just trying to wind us up." Which was right. He was just trying to wind us up. My colleagues put up with it for a while, but they gave up on him eventually. I had a different idea. I thought he likes talking. Just let him. Eventually, he'll say something useful. She tapped her shining little device. It spoke with Lawrence Arne Sales's haughty, drawling voice.
"You think that all my talk about other worlds is irrelevant, but it isn't. It's absolutely key. Matthew Rose Sorensen attempted to enter another world. If he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have disappeared, as you call it."
Raphael's voice answered him. Something about the attempt caused him to disappear.
"Yes," Lawrence Arne Sales again.
"Something happened to him during this ritual, whatever it was." "Why? Where do these rituals take place?"
"You mean, do we perform them on the edge of a precipice and he just fell off?" "No. Nothing like that. Besides, it needn't necessarily have been a ritual. I never use them myself."
"But why would he do that?" asked Raphael. "Why would he perform the ritual or do whatever it is? There's nothing in what he wrote to suggest he believed your theories. Quite the reverse, in fact."
"Oh, belief," said Arne Sales, laying a deep, sarcastic emphasis on the word. "Why do people always think it's a question of belief? It's not. People can believe whatever they want. I really couldn't care less."
"Yes, but if he didn't believe, why would he even try?"
"Because he had half a brain, and he recognized that mine was one of the great intellects of the 20th century. Perhaps the greatest of all. And he wanted to understand me. So he made the attempt to reach another world, not because he thought the other world existed, but because he thought the attempt itself would grant him insight into my thinking, into me. And now you are going to do the same."
"Me?"
Raphael sounded startled. "Yes. And you are going to do it for the exact same reason that Rose Sorensen did it. He wanted to understand my thinking. You want to understand his. Adjust your perceptions in the way I'm about to describe to you. Perform the actions that I will outline for you, and then you will know."
"What will I know, Lawrence?"
"You'll know what happened to Matthew Rose Sorensen."
"It's that simple."
"Oh, yes. It's that simple."
Raphael tapped the device. The voices fell silent.
"I didn't think that was a bad idea," she said, "to try and understand what you'd been thinking at the point you disappeared."
Arne Sales described what to do, how to go back to a pre-rational mode of thought. He said that when I'd done that, I'd see paths all around me, and he told me which one to choose. I thought he meant metaphorical paths. It was a bit of a shock when it turned out he didn't.
"Yes," I said. "Matthew Rose Sorensen was shocked when he first arrived. Shocked and frightened. And then he fell asleep. And I was born. Later, I found entries in my journal that frightened me. I thought that I must have been mad when I wrote them. But now I understand that Matthew Rose Sorensen wrote them
and he was describing a different world.
Yes.
And the other world has different things in it. Words such as Manchester and police station have no meaning here, because those things do not exist. Words such as river and mountain do have meaning, but only because those things are depicted in the statues. I suppose that these things must exist in the older world. In this world, the statues depict things that exist in the older world.
Yes, said Raphael.
Here you can only see a representation of a river or a mountain. But in our world, the other world, you can see the actual river and the actual mountain.
This annoyed me. I do not see why you say I can only see a representation in this world, I said with some sharpness. The word only suggests a relationship of inferiority. You make it sound as if the statue was somehow inferior to the thing itself. I do not see that that is the case at all. I would argue that the statue is superior to the thing itself, the statue being perfect, eternal, and not subject to decay.
Sorry, said Raphael. I didn't mean to disparage your world. There was a silence.
What is the other world like?
I asked.
Raphael looked as if she did not know quite how to answer this question.
There are more people, she said at last.
A lot more? I asked.
Yes.
As many as 70? I asked, deliberately choosing a high, rather improbable number.
Yes, she said. Then she smiled.
Why do you smile? I asked.
It's the way you raise your eyebrow at me. That dubious, rather imperious look. Do you know who you look like when you do that?
No.
Who?
You look like Matthew Rowe Sorensen.
Like photos of him that I've seen.
How do you know that there are more than 70 people? I asked. Have you counted them yourself?
No, but I'm fairly sure, she said. It's not always a pleasant world, the other world. There's a lot of sadness. She paused. A lot of sadness, she said again. It's not like here. She sighed. I need you to understand something. Whether you come back with me or not, it's up to you. Ketterly tricked you. He kept you here with lies and deceit. I don't want to trick you. You must only come if you want to. And if I stay here, will you come back and visit me? I said.
Of course, she said.
Other People. Entry for the 29th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the Southwestern Halls. For as long as I can remember, I have wanted to show the house to someone. I used to imagine that the 16th person was at my side, and that I would say to him such things as, Now we enter the first northern hall. Observe the many beautiful statues. On your right you will see the statue of an old man holding the model of a ship. On your left is the statue of a winged horse and its colt. I imagined us visiting the drowned halls together. Now we descend through this gash in the floor. We climb down the fallen masonry and enter the hall below. Place your feet where I place mine, and you will have no difficulty keeping your balance. The immense statues that are a feature of these halls provide us with safe places to sit. Observe the dark, still waters. We may gather water lilies here and present them to the dead. Today all my imaginings came true. The 16th person and I walked together through the house, and I showed her many things. She arrived in the first vestibule early in the morning. Will you do something for me? She asked.
Of course, I said.
Anything.
Show me the labyrinth.
Gladly. What would you like to see?
I don't know, she said.
Whatever you want to show me. Whatever's most beautiful. Of course, what I really wanted to show her was everything. But that was impossible. My first thought was the drowned halls, but I remembered that Raphael did not love climbing, so I decided on the coral halls, a long succession of halls extending south and west from the 38th Southern Hall. We walked through the southern halls. Raphael looked relaxed and happy. I was happy too. With every step, Raphael was looking around with pleasure and admiration. She said, "It's such an astonishing place. A perfect place. I saw some of it while I was looking for you, but I kept having to stop at the doors to write out the directions back to the Minotaur room. It got very time-consuming and frustrating. And of course, I didn't dare go too far in case I made a mistake." "You wouldn't have made a mistake," I assured her. "Your directions were excellent." "How long did it take you to learn it? The way through the labyrinth?" she asked. I opened my mouth to say loudly and boastfully that I have always known it, that it is part of me, that the house and I could not be separated. But I realized, before I even spoke the words, that it was not true. I remembered that I used to mark the doorways with chalk in exactly the same way that Raphael did, and I remembered that I used to be afraid of getting lost. I shook my head. "I don't know," I said. "I can't remember. Is it all right to take photos?" She held up her shining device. "Or is that not, I don't know, is that disrespectful in some way?" "Of course you may take photos," I said. "I took photographs sometimes for the other, for Dr. Ketterly." But I was pleased that she had asked the question. It showed that she regarded the house as I did, as something deserving of respect. Dr. Ketterly never learnt this. He seemed incapable of it, somehow. In the 10th Southern Hall, I made a detour to the 14th Southwestern Hall to show Raphael the people of the alcove. There are, as I have explained before, 10 of them and the skeleton of a monkey. Raphael regarded them gravely. She gently rested her hand on one of the bones, the tibia of one of the males. It was a gesture conveying comfort and reassurance. "Don't be afraid. You are safe. I am here." "We don't know who they are," she said. "Poor things." "They are the people of the alcove," I said. "Arne Sales probably murdered at least one of them. Perhaps he murdered all of them." These were solemn words. Before I could decide how I felt about them, she turned to me and said with great intensity, "I'm sorry. I'm really, really sorry." I was astonished, even a little alarmed. No one has ever been as kind to me as Raphael. No one has ever done more for me. That she should apologize seemed to me inappropriate. "No. No," I murmured, and I put up my hands to fend off her words. But she went on with a bleak, angry look on her face. "He'll never be punished for what he did to you, or for what he did to them. I've gone over it and over it in my mind, and there's nothing I can do, nothing he can be charged with. Not without a lot of explanation that literally no one will want to believe." She sighed deeply. I said that this is a perfect world. But it's not. There are crimes here, just like everywhere else. A wave of sadness and helplessness washed over me. I wanted to say that the people of the alcove had not been murdered by Arne Sales, though I have no evidence to support that assertion, and the probability is that at least one of them was. Mostly I wanted Raphael to come away from them, so that I could stop thinking of them the way she thought of them, as murdered, and go back to thinking of them the way I always had before, as good and noble and peaceful. We continued on our way, stopping often to admire a particularly striking statue. Our hearts grew lighter again, and when we reached the coral halls, we refreshed ourselves with looking at their wonders. Though the coral halls are dry now, it appears that at one time they were flooded with seawater for a long period. Coral has grown there, changing the statues in strange and unexpected ways. One may see, for example, a woman crowned with coral, her hands transformed into stars or flowers. There are figures horned with coral, or crucified on coral branches, or stuck through with coral arrows. There is a lion enmeshed in a cage of coral, and a man holding a little box, The coral has grown so profusely over his left side that half of him appears to be engulfed in red and rose-colored flames, while the other half is not. Late in the afternoon, we returned to the first vestibule. Just before we parted, Raphael said, "I love the quiet here. No people." She said the last part, as if it were the greatest advantage of all. "Don't you like the people in your own halls?" I asked, puzzled. "I like them," she said with no very great enthusiasm. "Mostly I like them. Some of them. I don't always get them. They don't always get me." After she had gone, I thought about what she had said. I cannot imagine not wanting to be with people, though it is true that Dr. Kettley was sometimes annoying. I remembered how Raphael had wondered which of the people of the alcove had been murdered, and how the simple fact of her posing the question had made the whole world seem a darker, sadder place. Perhaps that is what it is like being with other people. Perhaps even people you like and admire immensely can make you see the world in ways you would rather not. Perhaps that is what Raphael means. Strange Emotions. Entry for the 30th day of the 9th month in the year the Albatross came to the Southwestern Halls. I once wrote in my journal, "It is my belief that the world, or if you will, the house, since the two are for all practical purposes identical, wishes an inhabitant for itself to be a witness to its beauty and the recipient of its mercies. If I leave, then the house will have no inhabitant, and how will I bear the thought of it empty? Yet the simple fact is that if I remain in these halls, I will be alone. In one sense, I suppose I will be no more alone than before. Raphael has promised to visit me, just as the other visited me before. And Raphael really is my friend, whereas the other's feelings towards me were mixed, to say the least. Whenever the other left me, he went back to his own world. But I did not know that at the time. I thought that he was simply in another part of the house. Believing that there was someone else here made me less lonely. Now, when Raphael returns to the other world, I will know that I am alone. And so, for this reason, I have decided to go with Raphael. I have returned all of the dead to their allotted places. Today I walked through the halls as I have done 1,000 times before. I visited all my most beloved statues, and as I gazed on each one I thought, perhaps this will be the last time I look on your face. Goodbye. Goodbye. I leave. Entry for the first day of the 10th month in the year the Albatross came to the Southwestern Halls. This morning I fetched the small cardboard box with the word aquarium and the picture of an octopus on it. It is the box that originally contained the shoes Dr. Kettley gave me. When Dr. Kettley told me to hide myself from 16, I took the ornaments out of my hair and placed them in the box. But now, wanting to look my best when I enter the new world, I spent 2 or 3 hours putting them back in. All the pretty things that I have found or made, seashells, coral beads, pearls, tiny pebbles, and interesting fish bones. When Raphael arrived, she seemed rather astonished at my pleasant appearance. I took my messenger bag with all my journals and my favorite pens, and we walked towards the two minotaurs in the southeastern corner. The shadows between them shimmered slightly. The shadows suggested the shape of a corridor, or alleyway with dim walls, and, at the end of it, lights, flashes of moving color that my eye could not interpret. I took one last look at the eternal house. I shivered. Raphael took my hand. Then, together, we walked into the corridor.